Is there anything you would have done differently?
We reported a true story.
Our colleague Brian Williams is back in Kuwait City tonight after a close call in the skies over Iraq.
Controversial Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and questions about Kavanaugh's drinking in the past.
Sean Hannity, come on up, Sean Hannity.
Today, Andrew Cuomo is having a moment.
Well, hello. I am Chris Steyerwald.
And I'm Eliana Johnson.
Welcome to Insane Wretches, where we break down what's going wrong and what's going right with the American news media. And Eliana Johnson, let me tell you, I am a woodland creature by nature. I like the hills and vales. I like the forests of the Mid-Atlantic region. My point of origin and the home to Steyerwalds for many generations. But I got to tell you, this allergy business is for the birds. I have been, we're at the phase in DC's cycle where you wake up each day and everything is covered with a green, about the color of your sweater, actually, your lovely sweater, but everything is covered in pollen. And you go from having allergies to you feel like you have a systemic disorder. You don't sleep correctly, you don't feel correctly, everything is just pollinated. And I love you trees, but I've had it.
Well, I just was in a sneezing spell before we began.
So you won't defend the trees? You won't take up for the trees?
I'll totally defend the trees because we have like this beautiful cherry blossom tree in our front yard.
I'd also like to come out against the cherry tree. There's a lot of hype around the cherry tree around here. And the Japanese prime minister who was in town, was it the prime minister or the president? Prime minister. We'll go with prime minister for a state dinner, state visit with the Bidens, and they announced they were giving 250 more cherry trees. Cherry trees are played. The dogwood, the humble American dogwood, is a far superior tree, and DC's cherry blossom focus is, it's out of hand, and we need to get back to, they're taking jobs away from American trees. That's what these cherry blossoms are doing.
I love our cherry blossom tree.
Get a dogwood. Be a real American, Eliana.
Get a dogwood. I'm going to Google that right now. I don't really know anything about trees. Oh, I like this dogwood. It's nice.
It's hardier. It's the blossoms are more robust. It's more American.
Yeah, that's pretty. Mm-hmm. I can get down with that.
All right. Pro dogwood. And next week, we'll talk about the beauties of the rhododendron
bush. Hold on. Let me look that up.
Oh, the rhododendron is great. That is the dinosaur of beautiful flowering plants.
That looks nice.
The rhododendron is awesome, and it looks weird and like a dinosaur would have hidden
that
in it.
That looks like, what are the bigger ones that I had them at my wedding?
The azalea? The
No, you're going totally in the wrong direction. Oh my gosh.
It's like that. Okay, internet.
I can never remember their
name. It's the size of a pineapple is what we're supposed to understand. Is that correct?
Oh my gosh, this is going to drive me crazy.
Forsythia, hyacinth.
It's not a bush, it's a flower. Hydrangea.
There you go.
Why can't I should just put a sticker that says a hydrangea.
The hydrangeas are lovely. The hydrangeas are lovely.
Deer eat them, which is the problem, but they are so beautiful. They are so beautiful.
Hydrangeas are very beautiful, and I agree, but I'm still coming.
I absolutely love them.
I'm still coming down hard on trees in general, cherry trees in specific. Go dogwood.
Okay, Chris, on our front page. I was amused by all of the alerts we got on yesterday morning. Inflation higher than expected. The New York Times says inflation hotter than expected in March. Unwelcome news for the Fed. A closely watched measure of inflation remains stronger than expected in March. Worrying news for Federal Reserve officials who have become increasingly concerned that their progress on lowering price increases might be stalling. And then I get a Wall Street Journal alert last night that says the question isn't when interest rate decreases will happen, it's whether they will happen at all. And it made me wonder. They never say inflation increased as expected. Inflation spiked as economists predicted. Like, it's always totally unexpected and everyone's always shocked. And the coverage irks me because, in fact, there are a cadre of high-profile people who are saying that the ballooning size of the national debt is the underlying cause of the persistent inflation, and it's going to be really hard to get inflation down if we don't tackle the debt. So it's not like this should come as such a shock.
In general, I agree. Though in this case, I will say surprise was merited because this was a much bigger, this was much bigger than economists expected, right? This was a, like, not a, oh, okay, it's bumping around in the same range. This was a surprising jump at, especially on the year over year number. And the lesson, of course, is the expectation, once the expectation was set, the only thing, not the only thing, pretty much the only thing that markets care about is the Federal Reserve, because it's the only predictable thing, is that people know when the Federal Reserve cuts the interest rate that the economy improves. And that's what Wall Street is arranged around, the idea of just complaining about the Federal Reserve not cutting rates, and then when they cut them, not cutting them enough. And so I was captivated by how much, I mean, and look, it's very fair. We're an investor nation because of 401ks, because of IRAs. We are an investor nation, and people's futures are closely tied to the performance of investment markets. But there's more to life than the Federal Reserve.
Chris, I immediately thought of you when I read this piece. And look, the inflation stuff is problematic for Biden. I think it would help him a lot if the Fed cut interest rates. The inflation in and of itself is problematic for him because people feel it every day.
Grocery prices,
gas prices, everything. But then it would help him if the Fed cut interest rates because it would juice the housing market and everything else. Anyhow, second I saw this headline, I thought of you. Biden is spending $1 trillion to fight climate change, period. Voters don't care. And this was in the Wall Street Journal, and something that we've talked about a lot, which is, and this falls in a separate category. I thought this was quite a good piece because there's so much news coverage about climate change, and it does not correlate with what voter concerns actually are, I guess, except if you're the New York Times, which is just writing to its readership, which is not at all representative of the American public. But the Journal writes, a Journal poll which surveyed voters in 7 swing states in March found that just 3% of 18 to 34-year-old voters named climate change as their top issue, with most citing the economy, inflation, or immigration. I mean, man, remember, I think, was it last week or 2 weeks ago, we talked about the emergence of these climate cafes in cities around the country because people are just so anxious, so worried about climate change that they need to go find other people with the same concerns and be in these, you know, talk to them at cafes. So I'm picking back up with the Journal piece. That's roughly in line with voters of all ages, 2% of whom cited climate change as their top issue. Other polls show that young people are more likely than older voters to say addressing climate change is important, even if many don't name it as their top priority. Biden administration officials say climate is an economic issue and funding will create new jobs and industries in many communities. They're pushing to get cash out the door. I like that line. From the Biden administration, as if it's like not a zero-sum game, like you can just boost the green industry without hurting other industries. Anyhow, they're pushing to get cash out the door to show the economic impact. Biden's campaign hopes to highlight the differences between Biden and Donald Trump, who dismisses worries about climate change. Trump has criticized subsidies for electric cars while promising to increase domestic production of oil and gas. U.S. fossil fuel output has risen to record under Biden, but many voters in states with lots of oil industry jobs feel Trump and other Republicans would be better for them.
So the states that are in this survey are Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Georgia. Now, if you were to do this same poll nationally, you'd probably get a different result. It probably wouldn't be 3% if you included Massachusetts and Florida and California and Texas and New York and all of that and Virginia and Maryland. that number would go up substantially. And this points to the problem that Biden has. He is running in these states on average, what do we figure out, Nate? 6 points, about 6 points behind his 2020 performance. Who's in the 6 points? Because Trump is basically back where he was in these states. So what's the missing six points for Biden? They've not gone to Trump, right? Trump isn't doing better than he did in 2020, but Biden is doing worse. So who's the 6 points? The 6 points are some young people who care about climate change, but they're also persuadable suburban middle-class voters who are not interested in $1 trillion on climate. And if they knew that it was $1 trillion on climate, I guess I would say the real headline is Biden is spending $1 trillion to fight climate change. Voters don't know, and they're not that interested. And it wouldn't be good for Biden, in fact, if in these seven swing states, people said, boy, that guy is really spending a lot of money on climate change because it's just not the issue. And by the way, to your point about inflation, it goes to the same thing. This is not a moment where voters are enthused about big government interventions.
Chris, next up, we had a...
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to describe it as a whistleblower piece from NPR, published in the Free Press. The headline was, I've been at NPR for 25 years. Here's how we lost America's trust. And we've talked quite a bit about these things. The reporter, whose name is Uri Berliner, writes about the fact that within NPR, which has always been left-leaning, he saw a big change in the past 10 years. And he talks quite a bit about the lack of accountability to readers for their misses, one of which was Russiagate, and another of which was the Hunter Biden laptop, and essentially said, he talks about internal conversations where inside the newsroom, you hear people say, well, we don't want to cover the Hunter Biden laptop because that would help Trump. And then they hype Trump's Russia connections and the Mueller report, or the idea that Trump was a Russian asset and Russia collusion. And then when the Mueller report surfaced, no evidence of that, they really didn't come clean with their readers and say, look, we spent a lot of time covering this and it was a miss on our part. And same with the Hunter Biden laptop. So he says, when the Mueller report found no credible evidence of collusion, NPR's coverage was notably sparse. Russiagate quietly faded from our programming. It's one thing to swing and miss on a major story. Unfortunately, it happens. You follow the wrong leads, you get misled by sources you trusted, you're emotionally invested in a narrative, and bits of circumstantial evidence never add up. It's bad to blow a big story. What's worse is to pretend it never happened, to move on with no mea culpas, no self-reflection. Especially when you expect high standards of transparency from public figures and institutions, but don't practice those standards yourself. That's what shatters trust and engenders cynicism about the media. I would also add that he talks about how many interviews they did with Adam Schiff and being led by letting Schiff drive their coverage.
Woof.
Of this. When a colleague on our science desk was asked why they were so dismissive of the lab leak theory, the response was odd. The colleague compared it to the Bush administration's unfounded argument that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction, apparently meaning we won't get fooled again. But these two events were not even remotely related. Again, politics were blotting out the curiosity and independence that ought to have been driving our work. Despite all the resources we devoted to building up our news audience among Blacks and Hispanics, the numbers have barely budged. In 2023, according to our demographic research, 6% of our news audience was Black, far short of the overall U.S. adult population, which is 14.4% Black. And Hispanics were only 7% compared to the overall Hispanic adult population, around 19%. Our news audience doesn't come close to reflecting America. It's overwhelmingly white and progressive and clustered around coastal cities and college towns. There's another bit about how everything inside the newsroom became driven by identity. He writes, race and identity became paramount in nearly every aspect of the workplace. Journalists were required to ask everyone we interviewed their race, gender, and ethnicity, among other questions, and had to enter it in a centralized tracking system. We were given unconscious bias training sessions. A growing DEI staff offered regular meetings imploring us to start talking about race. Monthly dialogues were offered for women of color and men of color, non-binary people of color were included too. These initiatives, bolstered by a $1 million grant from the NPR Foundation, came from management from the top down. Crucially, they were in sync culturally with what was happening at the grassroots among producers, reporters, and other staffers. Most visible was a burgeoning number of employee resource or affinity groups based on identity. And you mentioned those groups, marginalized genders and intersex people of color mentorship program.
Sure.
Latinx, Latinx employees of color at NPR, NPR Noir, which is black employees at NPR, UMA for Muslim employees, women, gender expansive, and transgender people in technology throughout public media.
Yes.
Jewish Care, Jewish Heritage and Culture at NPR, and NPR Pride, LGBTQIA employees at NPR. I mean, peace, I think for those of us on the right, kind of like we already thought this, but I still found it really interesting to hear the details from somebody on the inside.
Well, sounds like Mr. Berliner. Yes, the Mr. Berliner made himself quite obnoxious about this to the leadership at NPR, asking for meetings, demanding meetings, doing all of those things, instead of quitting, which would seem like finding another job would seem like the more normal course of action in a situation like that. And I'm sure a lot of people quit, right? I'm sure a lot of people faced with this. The part of the piece that stayed with me is he's quoting the former president or CEO, John Lansing, who came in 2019. And it's this. He quoting from the piece, he declared that diversity on our staff and in our audience was our overriding mission, the, quote, North Star of the organization. Phrases like, that's part of the North Star, became part of meetings and more casual conversation. What is the North Star of a news organization supposed to be? What would you say the North Star of a news organization is supposed to be?
I would like to break some stories, some news.
The news would be the North Star of the organization. The North Star of your organization should be to tell the truth, to do it fairly, and to be of service to your audience and of service to the nation. That's the goal. And this is the problem about people not wanting to do their job, right? Yes, we should be inclusive. Yes, we should think about the ways in which we live and the things that we do affect other people, and we should be aware of systemic racism. All of those things are good things. That's all fine to think about. But if as soon as you swap out your North Star, which is your purpose, so what is the purpose of LaCroix water? To make money for its owners by selling delicious coconut flavored LaCroix or gross passion fruit LaCroix that tastes like your grandmother's perfume. But their job is not to change the way that Americans think about the environment or race or whatever else. Their job is to provide this product because that's how they fill their place in the world. And when you switch out North Stars for something that's not your job, you will go adrift because that's why all those people are there. That's why Yuri Berliner was there. That's why everybody was there. And if I can also say, 20 years ago, NPR was definitely left-leaning, but it was one of the fairest, right? You were more likely to get a variety of viewpoints. And I think they still do some of this, and there are good journalists who work at NPR. I listen to NPR. But the doctrinaire, narrative-shaped, reverse-engineered stories that come out of NPR, and this has also been true of the PBS NewsHour, the trend toward doing the same things that liberals decry in Fox News, but doing it for home cooking, has been very obvious, and it's been very unfortunate because it's the loss of what was a very valuable resource.
All right, up next. Something I'm quite happy to hear.
Yes.
The Wall Street Journal reports, we aren't posting on social media as much anymore. Will we ever? Excessive ads, bots, and misinformation have sucked the fun out of sharing publicly, users say. And the journal reports that billions of people access social media monthly, but users are posting less and facing a more passive experience, surveys of users and research from data analytics firms say. In an October report from data intelligence company Morning Consult, 61% of U.S. adult respondents with a social media account said they have become more selective about what they post. David Kennedy, a 27-year-old office assistant in Chicago, has four different TikTok accounts, three for posting, one for scrolling. An aspiring model, he loves to post photos on Instagram too. His friends, not so much. In a sea of Instagram reels from influencers, it is rare he spots a familiar face. He says most of his friends are watchers. It can kind of feel lonely sometimes, Kennedy says. If you're not seeing what your friends are posting, it kind of feels like you're living in an isolated world.
Well, I like this piece and I like this trend because it's about growing up. The idea that everyone would be posting all of the time and it would be this giant chattering world was always a little far-fetched. I think much more likely is the world where people want to passively consume. And I don't think it's just bots and whatever else. I think it is that people like to watch. They like to watch TV. They like to watch movies. They like to listen to things. And not everybody wants to be the star. Not everybody wants to be a celebrity. And I think this is good evidence of the maturation of social media and how we engage with it. I think this is healthy. I think it's normal.
Chris, you flagged a News Nation piece about hundreds of people. I'm not really sure if we can call this some massive trend. Hundreds of people tying the knot during the solar eclipse. Can I just say, I was like, who cares about the solar eclipse? Who cares? Who cares? Who cares? Everyone was talking about it. And then I actually went and looked at it and I was like, oh, this is kind of cool.
It is kind of cool. I included this here, as well as some interesting coverage. I did not include, but we also have some interesting coverage on the earthquake that hit New York. But the solar eclipse was, I can't recall the last time that I saw such wall-to-wall coverage of one event as the solar eclipse, and it had it all. So the transit of the solar eclipse, people, and no hate for the West Coast, but two-thirds of the United States lives basically along the path of the solar eclipse, which went from Texas to New York or Maine and transited across the Mississippi Valley, Ohio Valley, Mid-Atlantic, Northeast. So you have the audiences there, and it was schedulable. It was known long in advance so that we could say, let's get crews there, let's do whatever we can do, and it was visual. And man, I want to tell you, our business went totally hog wild on talking about the solar eclipse, up to and including this piece. And did you go outside and watch it? Did you wear glasses?
I was not outside and I watched it. Oh, no. Although I watched it with my eyes and then it was sort of easier to see with the glasses. But you look like such a dork with those glasses on.
But you also could burn your retinas out. So
I'll risk my precious retinas.
Retinas are overrated. Put them with the cherry blossoms. I was on in a very DC fashion. I was on a conference call while it occurred, but the strangeness of the quality of the light, and you definitely understood why the medieval peasantry was so powerfully awed by the fact that you could have darkness in the middle of the day while the sun was shining and all that stuff. A Yankee in King Arthur's court came to mind, and I get it. But yes, the news media definitely went hog wild, including this piece about hundreds of wedding registrations for people who, like in medieval peasant fashion, decided that they would stand under the eclipse to be wed as it transited over.
I was quite happy with my...
Your choices?
COVID pre-vaccination wedding.
Yes, there you go.
As opposed to my eclipse wedding.
Could have been good. Could have been
if you, wedding. If you could have been lit.
If you could have a play, if you could have a plague and a eclipse for your wedding at the same time, then you'd really have it all.
I actually laughed out loud at this next one.
Take it.
The Guardian had a piece. The headline is mostly felt like a speed bump. U.S. man on getting vasectomy amid earthquake. I thought maybe a train was passing by or it was just something that happens at the office, even when the doctor was like, I think this is an earthquake. I figured he was messing with me, but he had to stop because everything was shaking, Allen told The Guardian. Alan said the doctor operating on him, quote, put the tools down for a moment. We talked about how we'd never forget where we were at the moment, he said. According to the Mayo Clinic, many vasectomy procedures are done using local anesthesia, which means the patient will be awake and have medicine to numb the surgery area. Asked if an earthquake during such a sensitive procedure concerned him, Alan showed pure bravery. I really wasn't worried because he had walked me through every step of the procedure, so it mostly felt like a brief speed bump, and we were mostly just calm and laughing as the room shook, he explained.
Well, I don't know that all gratitude that Justin Allen was not harmed in this procedure, but I think we will use the Appalachian piece of advice, which is I don't know that I'd have told that one if I was him, but based on a person who posted that picture of himself giving a double thumbs up in front of the Urology Health Surgery Center, I guess he is not averse to sharing the most intimate details of his life on this earth.
That headline was amazing. Chris, that brings us to our Fossil Files.
And a nice chunk here.
This was great. Semaphore reports, hey, the good news about the border crisis. The border crisis might be a boon for the economy. And the lead is, the daily march of migrants across the southern border has been a political curse for President Joe Biden. But for the economy, it may have turned out to be a blessing. I mean, as we know, the economy's booming. Inflation just ticked up. By adding millions of new workers to the labor market, the immigration surge has lifted payrolls and growth and potentially helped keep a lid on consumer prices, according to recent research. Capitol Hill's budgeteers also think it stands to reduce the deficit in the coming years.
So the Semaphore has a helpful structure in which they have a section in their stories called Room for Disagreement, in which the author takes the counter view and offers the counter view. It's sort of a institutionalized to be sure paragraph. And I waited for it in this one to say, someone is going to point out here that what the author is doing is conflating legal immigration, the surge of migrants at the border. Now, of the point and a half or 1.7 points of GDP growth that they attribute to, that is attributed here in the various sources, but they put together to say U.S. economy has grown instead of 2 points higher than our closest competitors around the world, has grown 4 points higher than our closest, 4 points more than our closest competitors around the world. And the economy is good, right? Inflation is high, but the economy is good and jobless rates are low. And that's all true. But who are those foreign-born workers? Are those foreign-born workers mostly people who have surged across the border recently seeking asylum? I bet not. I bet that most of the people who are reflected in this are the million plus people who legally enter the United States each year and get work permits and do that part. So there is a profound bit of base stealing going on here in which two different things are treated as one thing.
The best line in the whole piece is the following. Since the report started trickling out over the past few months, I've been joking that it's a bit like Biden ran an accidental experiment to test the economic impact of open borders, and it turned out better than anyone could have hoped.
Better than anyone could have hoped. People are thrilled. People are just happy. And again, you have to acknowledge that multiple things can be true. It can be true that that immigration is good for the economy. It can also be true that there are costs associated with immigration. It's not either or. As the great Megan McArdle says, behold the power of and, right? It's not, are immigrants good or bad for the economy? Immigrants are good and bad for the economy.
Chris, up next, we could not do a Fossil Files without the Washington Post.
They deliver the goods on this one.
And they have a piece, which Trump lies stick? Republicans believe some falsehoods more than they did 6 years ago, our poll finds. With Trump barreling toward November, when Americans will have a chance to choose him to lead the nation again, the Washington Post fact checker sought to get a sense of the staying power of his lies, whether people are more or less likely to believe them over time and which lies prove the stickiest, as well as measure the value Americans place in a president's honesty, however they define it. Even more significant, Americans appear to have diverged on the meaning of honesty itself. among Republicans, fewer now say that Trump regularly makes misleading statements. Do you think that's because we're maybe hearing and seeing a little bit less of him? Slightly more view him as more honest than they did in 2018, despite an extraordinarily large amount of evidence that Trump often does not tell the truth. During Trump's presidency, the fact checker documented more than 30,000 misleading or outright false claims. And since he began his second campaign for the White House against Joe Biden, he's introduced new falsehoods to his catalog. Inflation is almost 50% under Joe Biden. Nearly 1 million jobs held by native-born Americans have been lost to immigrants. In a single December interview with Fox News host Sean Hannity, Trump made 24 false or misleading claims in 5 minutes, one every 12.5 seconds. What is your take?
So the here's the list of, for their purposes, their list of what the falsehoods are. So they have an average in which Republicans went from being slightly fewer than half of Republicans to slightly more than half of Republicans is the average Trump falsehood belief score. But here are the falsehoods that go into their nexus. Biden won the 2020 election due to voter fraud. 81% of Republican, 81% of strong Trump approvers agree. Okay, I believe that's a fact that has moved in that direction. U.S. funds the majority of the budget of NATO. Now, is that a lie, or is that people don't know what NATO is? I don't know, right? Like, how much of that is based on ignorance and how much of that is based on deception? Unclear. Some cities tallied more votes in the 2020 election than the number of registered voters in the city. 58% of strong Trump supporters, about half of Republicans overall, believe that. But here's, and then there's the U.S. unemployment rate is not close to its lowest level in about 50 years. Do you think that average people know what the U.S. unemployment rate is on a 50-year average? And that if you ask them in a survey, whether they can say, yes, now that you mention it, this does compare well to the 1983 Reagan rebound. So now that you mention it, yes, I think that's right. Also can be explained by ignorance, or partly explained by ignorance. And some of it is just explained by partisanship. If you ask somebody totally stone drunk on Republican partisanship, just as it would be true under Trump of a Democrat, how's the economy doing? What are they going to tell you every time? It's terrible. It's terrible. Why is it terrible? Because the bad people are in charge. There is evidence that millions of fraudulent votes were cast in the 2016 presidential election. I totally believe that 47% of hardcore Trump supporters believe that and that it's a lie and all that stuff. But here's my favorite that sums it up. Here's the lie. The global temperature has been increasing in recent decades because of natural causes, not human activity. And they're putting this, so they have these, like, what's the unemployment rate compared to the last 50 years? What about global temperature increase, anthropogenic climate change?
I don't even know what you just did to that word.
Isn't it anthropomorphogenic?
Anthropomorphic, I think.
Anthropomorphic? I don't know.
Let's look it up.
We're going to look it up. Please write us. But climate change, the unemployment rate, NATO's budget, these are things that can be explained in part.
Okay, anthropomorphic is thought of as having a human form or human characteristics.
Right.
It's not the same as...
So it's the genic part is the created by...
Anthropomorphogenic?
What do we got?
My head's spinning now. Anthropomorphogenic?
Something like that.
That's not a word. Anthropogenic. Anthropogenic. Yes. Anthropogenic.
Anthropogenic. Okay.
Yes,
so
anthropogenic.
The anthropogenesis of global warming is included with things like the NATO budget and the unemployment rate in categories that people may be misinformed. And on global warming, they might just actually legitimately disagree. So what happens with this effort to hold Trump accountable for his lies, if you batch in stuff that is subjective or you batch in other stuff, you're padding your numbers and you yourself, and I'm not accusing them of intentionally deceiving people, but you yourself are adding to, dare I say, misinformation by lumping this stuff together and pretending like it's all the same thing. Harumph. That's anthropogenic misinformation.
We have another Washington Post special.
Primo.
Gen Z workers can take criticism. You're just phrasing it wrong.
Phrasing it wrong.
Young workers want feedback and lots of it. But if you deliver it in the wrong ways, it could backfire.
Mm-mm.
This is, you know, this is like really, it's not you, it's me.
Yeah.
So the Post writes, your youngest colleagues may be the newest to the workplace, but they have clear expectations about how they would like to receive feedback. It should be timely, collaborative, empathetic, and balanced. So, you know, you have to change. The old people have to change to accommodate the young people. But if you wait weeks or months to address an issue, fix their mistakes without a conversation, or focus only on what went wrong, they just might leave and find a workplace that connects with them better. You know what? Godspeed.
Godspeed.
Godspeed. Generation Z, or those born between 1997 and 2012, are shaking up workplace norms, including how critical feedback is delivered. Cultures clash when older generations, who may have gone without much explanation or care in their early careers, critique younger workers in ways that unintentionally alienate or discourage them. Experts who study the multi-generational workforce say, I would love to meet one of these people. Gen Z is only going to become a larger part of the workforce, blah, 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 blah. Rather than just saying, hey, you did this wrong, say, I'd like to have a conversation on where your thought process was and where you went wrong, said Yatri Patel, a 24-year-old software engineer at the Tennessee Valley Authority, said, help me understand.
I think Nate would say that's how I operate mostly, right? It's we have a conch that we pass back and forth to talk about how things have gone, and we first get the vibes right, and then we talk about what's going on and the thought process and the motivation behind it.
Every single interaction does matter, said Sarah Warren, 26, who is a Los Angeles-based executive director and co-founder of a mental health nonprofit for healthcare workers. You're dealing with human beings. You can help stop burnout through vulnerability and compassion.
I mean, true enough. Like, I don't object to compassion. Vulnerability, we can talk about. But what's alluded to here, and I didn't read the piece closely enough to say that they didn't talk about this, but the economy is good and the labor market is tight, right? The labor market is very, very tight. So you're a millennial. This is true?
Yes, I'm a millennial.
You're a millennial. What was the experience of millennials entering the workforce? The labor market was not tight. The labor market was capacious. After the recession that preceded and followed 9/11, after the panic of 2008 and the recession that followed that, the labor market was not tight and jobs were much harder to find, especially good paying jobs. For the youngest workers, they have come of age in a period of, yes, they had the pandemic, but the job market has been tight, tight, tight. And so they obviously, many of them feel like they are entitled to be treated like unicorns and precious things and not forced to do what you had to do, which is figure it out. When you do it wrong in life, I did it wrong a lot of times, and it's good to be told why you got something wrong. Context is helpful, and it's you don't want to make people fearful of making mistakes, but you want to make sure that they understand when mistakes have been made. But ultimately, what did you have to do? You had to figure it out. You had to figure out how to be. You had to learn from your mistakes and figure out how to be. And I'm all for being nice to people. I think being nice is super, but wow.
I also think this idea that like the old people should change to be more like the young people is totally like turns on its head that older people know more based on their experience and have something to teach the young people, including like the way they deliver feedback.
Right. The piece is written as advice for employers to try to retain employees. But a more useful piece would have been, hey, younger workers, you don't know this, but you're annoying everyone where you work with your fragility. So here are some tips for how to take criticism without exploding into a million little pieces.
And then I actually, this is like a huge epidemic. And what I don't think younger people are told enough is that you're not going to get a ton of feedback. yes, people are going to go change your stuff. Sometimes feedback is going to be harsh, but a lot of your job is to watch what's happening around you. Watch the people who are good at what they do. Observe. Change what you do accordingly. Watch the people who are bad at what they do and don't succeed. Change what you do accordingly. There's not like an instruction manual. And it's true. Like, young people are, they want like way too much feedback. And they think there's an instruction manual that comes with life that will get you from here to there. And so much is watching, observing, tweaking how you go through and do things. And you're not going to get instructions from people delivered in the perfect way. That's just not reality.
You got to
do not have time for that.
You got to figure it out.
Got to figure it out.
As they would say on the North Fork of Short Creek, root hog or die.
Yeah. Okay. What do we have next here? Oh.
Get excited.
Chris, that brings us to our style section. We have been talking about Don Lemon because he, after Elon Musk canceled his show on X, we learned that he wanted to do the first podcast in space, courtesy of a SpaceX rocket, and he wanted a Tesla truck and, you know, zillions of dollars. And so Page Six caught my attention when they noted that Matt Lauer was spotted at Don Lemon's wedding and with his new girlfriend. Of course, Matt Lauer was dumped by NBC when he was accused of having the hidden door lock button under his desk so that he could keep women in his office and sexually assault them in there. So I found it amusing to see that sexual assailants were welcome at Don Lemon's wedding. And it says the couple, Matt Lauer and girlfriend Shaman Abbas, were two of approximately 140 guests at former CNN host Don Lemon and Tim Malone's nuptials. A number of those guests included celebrities such as View co-host Sonny Hostin, Joy Behar, and Anna Navarro, as well as Alec Baldwin, Real Housewives of New York City alum Luann Delicep, and Today alum Tamron Hall. Star-studded affair definitely earned a place in our style section. Also, the Daily Mail noted, had a piece, Jennifer Garner and Ben Affleck's 15-year-old daughter, formerly Serafina Rose, debuts new name Finn, and they thought it was appropriate to snag photographs of the couple's, I guess, apparently transgender child giving a eulogy at his or her, whatever, grandfather's funeral and post pictures all over the paper, and it was ridiculous. I guess the funeral service was streamed online.
On Facebook.
And yeah, so that was gross.
I hate this so much. And I think the reason
the kid's 15.
Yeah. And I think the reason I hate it so much, the reason that it grabbed me so much was that this took place in Charleston, West Virginia, where I lived for 12 years. I've been in this church. And Jennifer Garner grew up not far from there. Her father was a chemical engineer and worked at a plant not far from there. And it's his funeral. And I guess the church live streamed it on Facebook. And the Daily Mail watched the Facebook feed. And so this child, Finn, has to have Ben Affleck for a father. So this child is already facing a huge disadvantage in life that Ben Affleck, of all people, would be your dad is a really, that is a bad place to start. And you have to grow up with the paparazzi chasing you. You have to grow up with all of this stuff. And Finn Affleck is obviously going through a lot at age 15. And my heart is with that family and as they try to figure all this stuff out, and it's very hard. But I included this because I wanted to say, celebrity content, when you click, what you're supporting is this, right? We love celebrity news. We love whatever. But the insatiable appetite among the American audience for celebrity news brings us to absolute garbage like this, of violating somebody's funeral, not because they could get pictures. Yeah, they could watch the Facebook stream. They could do it. And it wasn't that they violated some legal barrier to watch this Facebook stream and hold this family up for ridicule at this child's grandfather's funeral, but that they could have chosen not to. And I would just say, when it comes to celebrity content, you, the reader, the viewer, the consumer, can choose not to click. And it may seem like innocent fun, and it may seem like whatever, but, and that I say it all the time about political trash, about siloed, biased, angry, stupid political content. And I don't spend much time around celebrity content, but garbage like this, cruelty like this, division like this, hatred like this, don't support it. Don't give it the click.
Up next, children. Oh, this was so. Oh, okay. Sorry. I skipped one. We have the journal on a couple trading. The headline is "The Couple Trading Restless Nights for Separate Bedrooms." And I'm totally pro this. I could see this at some point in my future. My husband's been out of town this week and I'm sleeping so well.
You're enjoying it?
Yeah. Which, and he doesn't even do anything. Like, he's fine. But they report that many couples today are opting for a sleep divorce instead of following the typical marital path of sharing a bed. And they write, Ryan Pearson, 47, has restless leg syndrome and on one occasion punched his wife, Elizabeth, 42, in the face while sleeping, she said. Waking up angry at him every morning was driving a rift in the relationship. Like the Pearsons, many couples today are opting for a sleep divorce, choosing to use so-called snore rooms or dual primary bedrooms instead of following the typical marital path of sharing a bed. According to a survey conducted in March 2023 by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, 35% of Americans sleep in separate rooms occasionally or consistently. Could totally see that.
And my only critique here is not new. Not new. Not a new thing. Not a new trend. This is something, if you look at how people lived 100 years ago, there were sleeping porches. There were people, dudes are the worst. We snore. We're difficult. We're problematic sleepers. And I get it. And it's just that it's not new.
Finally, we had a reader flag this incredible local television news segment about a young kid who decided he wanted to dress up for school.
And we talked about this kid last week.
We did.
We told the story of this young man last
week. Oh, right. So we got to play some of this video.
So good.
Let's hit it. It's wonderful.
Most 8-year-old boys don't get dressed to the nines. To them, suits are for bathing, and formal is a 4-letter word. But James Ramage of Chelsea, Maine, loves to dress for third grade success. He started a couple years ago, and at first, the other kids didn't know what to think.
Every time I saw him, I was just like, okay. And I'm like, why is he dressing up?
James knew he stood out.
Did you just decide one day, I don't care what other people
yeah.
are wearing?
I don't need to look like them anymore. I can be who I want to be.
Very heartwarming. And we will include the link in our newsletter so that you can actually watch the video, because you got to see it. The kid's suit is green. It's great. 3-piece suit.
My man. That's all I say about that. That kid is all right.
Chris, that brings us to our obsessions of the week, where we break down the stories we can't get out of our heads. And Chris, my obsession is the coverage of House Speaker Mike Johnson and the Ukraine aid bill he is going to bring onto the House floor. And I was struck by how difficult it would be if you were a layperson who wasn't following this very closely to figure out what's actually happening here. All of the mainstream media news coverage is focused on, will Mike Johnson keep his job? And that part is valid. But on the Senate in February passed a bill that had both Ukraine aid and Israel aid. And since then, the White House and Democrats have been pressing the House Speaker to bring this bill to the House floor, given that Ukraine aid is a an issue that divides Republicans, and Johnson is likely to need to lean on Democrats to ferry this bill through the House. However, Israel is now an issue. The Israel aid is now an issue that divides the Democrats.
Right.
And the headlines have been so politically charged and misleading on this that I think it would be quite difficult to figure out what exactly is going on and what blame, if any, Democrats should shoulder for tanking this bill if it comes to the floor and doesn't pass. And the examples that jumped out at me were both from Politico. The first, what followed the tragic deaths of the seven World Central Kitchen aid workers. And the playbook headline was, "Could Bibi tank Ukraine aid?" And what that really meant was that Democrats would no longer support this aid bill because they were outraged at Israel and they would defect from this bill because they were angry at Bibi, i.e., they would not support aiding Ukraine in its war against Russia because they did not want to give the Israel aid. And that was totally absent. It was like, Bibi's such a jerk. Bibi will have tanked the Ukraine aid bill. That was the actual headline. And it would have been very difficult to discern what was actually happening here. The second was in West Wing playbook. West Wing playbook headline, "The politics of Israel are changing." And the lead was, "Many prominent Democrats have been critical of the Israeli government's conduct of the war. But among the most persistent and surprising has been Patrick Gaspard. As president and CEO of the Center for American Progress, Gaspard runs the most influential Democratic allied think tank in politics, one that has historically been supportive of both Democratic administrations and the state of Israel. In that capacity, he's been willing to criticize Joe Biden's administration and been scathing in his assessment of Benjamin Netanyahu." And this is framed as incredibly surprising, a change in the politics of Israel. And in reality, Patrick Gaspard came to be CEO of the Center for American Progress from running the Open Society Foundation, which is 100% funded by George Soros, who is totally hostile to the state of Israel, to its existence as a Jewish state. And I went and looked up, well, what does Open Society do in Israel and what have they said about Israel? And their page says, "The Open Society Foundations have been working in Israel and Palestine since 1999 with a focus on the rights of minorities in Israel." Because, you know, they compared to the rights of minorities in the rest of the Middle East, this is a major issue in Israel. "The rights of Palestinians living under Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza and efforts towards reaching a peaceful resolution to the conflict. We work on the principle that all people living in Israel and in the occupied Palestinian territories have a right to safety and dignity. We have proudly supported efforts to improve the living conditions and rights of Palestinians," blah, blah, blah. They support human rights organizations that document Israeli abuses and advocate for accountability. And their partners are focused on arts and culture, women's rights, LGBTQ plus rights. You know, Israel is the only state in the Middle East where gays actually have rights. Disinformation and other issues affected by the conflict. So, and Politico frames this as, this is a totally shocking turn that this man is speaking out against Israel. And then I looked at, well, what has he actually said? Has he actually been supportive of Israel in this conflict? Patrick Gaspard, who also was Obama's ambassador to South Africa. South Africa, of course, brought the genocide case against Israel in the International Criminal Court. Patrick Gaspard called for a ceasefire in November, a month after Hamas attacked Israel.
Strange and bedfellows.
So it is so factually incorrect and totally misleading. And then the first question to him, this is actually an interview with him. So they just give him an open platform to spout off. The first question to him in the interview is, "You were active in the protests against the apartheid government in South Africa. Do you see parallels between that moment and now?" Second question. "Shortly after the war began, you warned that if there is overwhelming punishment for Palestinians, quote, there will be a loss of moral clarity. Have we hit that point?"
Mm.
Why do you believe the Biden administration doesn't see this as clearly as you do?
What?
Yeah. Do you believe Israel is a democracy under Netanyahu? The backdrop to this is a growing number of prominent Democrats being openly critical of Israel. Your boss, your old boss, President Barack Obama, early on was among them. Comment.
About that.
Like, quite literally, there is not one challenging question to him, including Joe Biden led his State of the Union speech framing Ukraine aid as, like, this is a 1941 moment, and it is so important that we pass this. Like, do you fear that tanking Israel aid could cause America to, like, cede its moral position as a global leader in the world? No, there's no question like that in here. No challenging question for him at all. Just an open platform to spout his, you know, political BS. So it did lead me to believe that, like, if you're trying to understand the political moment here and what the issues are and what the cleavages are in the Democratic Party, in the Republican Party, like, this is an interesting political moment. Like, you're not going to understand them from reading Politico, which is supposed to be, like, the publication that helps you understand the Beltway. So this was my obsession.
That interview is a real beaut. That's a real
doozy. It's unbelievable.
Why are you so right? Why are the bad people so wrong? Okay, my obsession can be brief because I recorded a whole podcast about it, the Remnant podcast, filling in for Jonah Goldberg. A book came out not too long ago called White Rural Rage, and it's garbage. It's a terrible book in many, many ways. Methodologically dubious and invites the kind of us versus them, cultural siloing and resentment that is hurting the country so much. It's really bad. Now, the authors were getting quite a hearing about their claim that the white rural people in America were this existential threat to the Republic and all this stuff. And I ignored it. You know why I ignored it? Because who cares, right? People say a lot of things. People write a lot of bad books, and that's okay. And I wasn't going to elevate it. But it kept burning. It kept going. And when Paul Krugman wrote a piece in the New York Times basically saying we should pity these hillbillies, but they do represent this massive threat to the country. And I thought, well, you surely wouldn't write a book called Black Urban Rage, would you? You surely wouldn't write a book called Hispanic Rage and get the kind of response that this guy got, these authors got, with this specious argument and weak pseudoscientific sociological research. And it sort of got up my nose. And then I read the piece by Tyler Austin Harper in The Atlantic, where he said what was on my heart. And so I had the opportunity to interview him, and he is very smart, and he is very good. I recommend his work at The Atlantic. I recommend the podcast I recorded with him and the discussion of this. And it was really good and really worthwhile. And he is definitely a man of the left. He is definitely comes from he looks at the world differently than I do in several respects. But the humanity that he evinced and the decency that he summons us to is worth paying attention to. And I will include as one other part of my obsession, I have written and talked about the recklessness of people cosplaying and fantasizing about the coming civil war in the United States. And there's a movie that's coming out about the Civil War, which I have decried that's exactly the wrong kind of thing. And another piece in The Atlantic, and as was pointed out to me by a very good friend of mine, is that while this movie is exploiting these divisions and playing on the fears that Americans have, the director went to great pains to make sure that it wasn't Red America versus Blue America. So I probably will never see this movie because who needs it? But we will include the link to the piece about the politics of the Civil War movie as part of me acknowledging that perhaps my initial assessment of the movie was unfair.
Chris, That brings us to my favorite time of the week, which is reader mail.
Do it.
And we have a note from Christian Costa in London.
Oh, hi, Christian.
Who writes, "Hi, wretches. Just a reporter pun from across the pond that made me chuckle. Keep up the great work and big congrats to Chris on his engagement." And this is a BBC News headline. "School bus gets stuck under low bridge again."
By, what's the name of the author?
It's great. By Caroline Lowbridge.
There you go. There you go. Congrats. And it's so good to thank you, Christian. I worked with Christian at Fox. She's great. She's wonderful to work with. And she's over in London being famous and important and a big deal and all that jazz. So thanks, Christian.
And the next one is from Aaron and Nick, who live in D.C. "Hi, Chris and Eliana. My name is Aaron, and my husband Nick and I are swamp creatures. We listen to your podcast every week. I wanted to flag a funny crossover of pop culture and politics that I thought y'all may get a kick out of. In addition to being a loyal Ink-Stained Wretches listener, I also enjoy the daily pop culture podcast, The Toast. The hosts, sisters Jackie and Claudia Oshry, were the target of a 2018 Daily Beast article that resulted in the cancellation of their first show and was written by none other than Taylor Lorenz.
Ding.
The piece was essentially a hit piece attempting to cancel them because of their mom and her political ideologies. Their mom is Pamela Geller.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And their father is a wealthy business guy.
Okay.
The hosts ended up losing their show and endorsements following the piece, and the sisters had to climb their way back and are now even more successful following this clash with Lorenz. Jackie and Claudia celebrated 6 years of The Toast at the beginning of their episode on Tuesday, while also taking a stroll down memory lane about the impacts of the Daily Beast article and their subsequent cancellation. The clip is about 3 minutes long, and I recommend giving it a listen. It's a profanity-laced tirade against Taylor and the takedown gotcha journalism that she's most famous for. And Aaron and Nick have linked the tirade that we will put in our newsletter. Thought it was a funny crossover and just goes to show that even news that's not really about the news can drive people crazy. Thank you for all of your smart takes. We love hearing them every week.
That's the perfect Wretches crossover. You've got Taylor Lorenz into pop culture news. You got it all.
Yes. Chris, that brings us to our favorite items of the week, where I am forced to say something nice, but please lead by example.
Well, I just love this piece in the New York Times. It's a guest essay by Jordan Baumgarten, who is a Philadelphia-based photographer. Headline, "How a Vacant Lot Became Our Own Dirtbag Narnia." And it doesn't have much of a political point. It doesn't have much of a point beyond a scene. And it's a story with great pictures about what happened in one transitioning Philadelphia neighborhood and the lesser dirtbag Eden that the residents of this neighborhood formed in a vacant lot and what it was like. It's just a beautiful little sketch. It's well written. It's well told. I really enjoyed it.
Chris, mine was a piece in Jewish Insider that is documenting a trend that's come with a lot of amusing videos. Several university leaders begin cracking down on anti-Israel disruptions on campus. This is surely the result of the, I think, reverse incentives or whatever. The incentives of these guys don't want the news coverage and they don't want to be hauled before the House Education Committee and asked to testify about their uneven enforcement of campus rules. But the lead is about the Pomona College professor who confronted 150 student protesters who had refused to leave. They stormed her office and refused to leave for 3 hours. And this woman,
we're linking the president
of Pomona College. And we're going to link the Jewish Insider article, which talks about the trend. And I want to note for our listeners that the president of Columbia University is going to testify before Congress next Wednesday. So we'll probably talk about that on next week's podcast, depending on how it goes. And Columbia, which had some of the worst incidents on their campus right after October 7th, has really started to crack down on students. Last week, they suspended 4 students. They have one student who was suspended who's refusing to leave his campus dorm room. And that's turning into a big drama on their campus. So anyhow, the Columbia president will testify next Wednesday. We'll talk about it next week. But the video of the Pomona College professor.
President.
Sorry. Pomona College president confronting the student protesters.
Can we play
her
a little?
Her name is Gabby Starr. We have got to play this video. She is making a real run for Free Beacon Man of the Year.
Excuse me? Everyone in this building is immediately subject to suspension. Harassment is following me with a camera. That is now clear. If you do not leave within the next 10 minutes, every student in this building is immediately suspended from this institution. If you are from Pomona, if you are from elsewhere, you immediately will be banned from this campus. Is that clear? 10 minutes.
Get
so
it.
Good. So
Get
good. It. So good. Chris, that is all the time we have for the news about the news. If you have a story you want us to talk about, email us at wretches@nebulouspodcasts.com and sign up for our newsletter at nebulouspodcasts.com. This has been Ink-Stained Wretches from Nebulous Media, produced this week by Jennifer Huffel. Find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review. Just search for Wretches.